Good morning. We are very happy that you're with us today. I see a good number of folks here who are visiting that aren't normally with us, and we're especially glad that you've been able to come and help us in our worship of God, be able to greet you, and hopefully spend some time now studying some things that I hope will be useful for each one of us as we consider them together. You can be turning to Exodus chapter 5, if you would please. We're going to really just read one verse from there and then maybe flip through a few other pages from Exodus as we go before getting to the heart of our lesson. But we'll read first from Exodus chapter 5. We find a statement made there in verse 21. As the Lord had called Moses to lead His people out of Egypt, had called him to lead them to be His people that would be devoted to Him, the Lord, specially. God had called Moses to begin that effort. And things did not go as well as the Israelites had expected and maybe assumed after Moses first had his encounter with Pharaoh. In fact, the work that was oppressing them so heavily grew to be even worse. Pharaoh was upset at the fact that Moses had come asking for help from the people and that they should be able to be let go instead of being slaves in that nation. He made their burdens even worse than they had been before. This is a rather innocuous, innocent-seeming verse or statement that the Israelites, they are the speakers in verse number 21, who come to the them, that is Moses and Aaron, the God-appointed leaders of Israel. The Israelites say to Moses and Aaron, "Let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." He said, "You have not helped anything. You've only made things worse by going to Pharaoh and trying to get some relief for us." Again, seemingly innocent, and really, we could end up saying that this first cry of complaint has some ring of truth or justice about it. Although I wouldn't ultimately agree with that assessment, we can at least understand where these Israelites might be coming from. We thought things were going to improve. Right now, it only seems to be worse for us in the moment. This first generation of Israelites, I know there were children, descendants of Israel before this time, but now as they're beginning to be sculpted into a nation, this first generation was hardly a golden one. We tend to assume and think of the Israelites, the nation, as growing worse over time, and in large part that is true. But if we look at the very beginning of the people, the very beginning of the nation, they did not start well. In fact, this generation will end up with their corpses scattered in the wilderness because they were judged unfit to inherit the promises that God had made to Abraham. They will be largely responsible for the punishment of Moses, who finally rose up in anger and impatience against them. Moses, the most humble man to live on the face of the earth, a man we would have to consider one of the greatest leaders of men in human history, the man who oversaw the exodus of over a million people out of a nation and going to another place and doing that successfully with God's, well, not with God's assistance, we would say God with Moses assisting. But this great leader came to his end largely because of this rebellious nation. They leave behind them a legacy, perhaps more than anything else, of what we find beginning in Exodus 5, which is grumbling, complaining, murmuring. If we track through the rest of their story, which we won't do in detail, but it picks up again in chapter 14 of Exodus, and then chapter 15, and then chapter 16, and then chapter 17, and then again in chapter 32. You jump over to the book of Numbers, and you see in chapter 11, and chapter 12, and chapter 14, and chapter 16, and chapter 20, maybe for the last time in chapter 20. Some have counted up to 14 individual accounts, separate occasions, of the Israelites grumbling, complaining against God and against Moses, with the summary being given ultimately in the Psalms. If you do want to turn over to Psalm 78, which is one of the longer Psalms in this book, which details almost entirely the repeated shortcomings of this generation of people, this rebellious Israel. But the writer says to his own people at the time in verse 8 that he did not want them to be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. He says in verse 40, how often they provoked him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Israel is known for their complaints against God. They complain about water, not having enough of it, not having good water. They complain when they don't have food. Food is brought to them and they complain that they don't like that food. They want different food. Then an abundance of food is given and they overindulge and complain that there is too much food. They complain when the Egyptians are coming to take them back into slavery. They complain later that they are no longer in Egypt where things were so good and they had all of those nice things to eat. They complain that they don't know where they're going. They complain that they're going to die when an enemy encroaches against them. Everything that they can perceive that is going wrong, they do think is going wrong, and make that no secret in voicing their complaints, their grumbling to God, against Moses, against Aaron, against everyone who would try to lead them in the ways that were right. When we're talking about what complaining does in a group of people, in an individual's life, why it is such a great danger for each of us, I do want to clarify from the beginning what it is that we're not talking about. Because there are some things that we would find to be legitimate complaints, so to speak. For instance, we are not talking about making genuine, factual statements about the reality of evil, the presence and the horribleness of the wicked things that we see going on around us. In fact, we see God Himself doing this. Oftentimes in the prophets, for instance, you think of Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 1, where Jeremiah is beginning his career, more or less, as a prophet of God. The Lord tells him to go and to cry out against the people. Go and cry in the hearing of Jerusalem, thus says the Lord. We find in the book of Hosea, chapter 4 and verse 1, that God has a charge against Israel. We think of that setting up a courtroom scene, and some of the language of complaint is held up today in our courtroom scenes. When you read about the plaintiff of a trial, you're talking about someone who has a complaint, who has a grievance against someone else. And in their minds, and oftentimes in the eyes of the court, when the verdict is given, it's a legitimate grievance. And here, and in other instances, all throughout many books of prophecy and Psalms, we find God saying to Israel, you have done something which is wrong, and it's not good. And the prophets go to them, and they're not complaining, they're not whining, they're revealing the reality of this evil that persists. We can, and we should, reveal the world's evil to others in a constructive way. We can improve our lives. We can improve others' lives by getting them to avoid or to stop doing what is sinful, what is harmful to them. And we can point them towards a better and eternal life. And sometimes this will come about by being able to say, look at this evil. Look at this horrible thing that is going on. Look at what men have done to ruin something which God created, which was good. Well, we can complain about the world, but we can also at times simply make factual statements about the things that it does which we know are not right and can help others to avoid them. Complaining is not going to others to share a legitimate burden. If we are telling someone about a serious struggle, something that is a real, genuine concern for us, and we're enlisting them to pray for us, we are asking them to help us, we are asking them to fulfill their role and their obligation as our brother. We've been studying from Galatians chapter 6 in our morning class the last couple of weeks. Bear one another's burdens. So fulfill the law of Christ. Well, if we're enlisting someone to do that, with that intention in mind, I'm not unburdening myself to complain about every little thing that's going on in the world, but I am going through some serious difficulties, and I need you to help. Can you help? That's not a complaint. That is what God seemingly wants us to do with our brethren. Let me add in addition to this, since this is a difficult determination for the hearer to make, is he complaining or is he doing what Christians should do? He's trying to share the burden with me. I don't always know. You're not always going to know when someone is unburdening themselves, maybe. So don't assume which one the complainer is doing. Just listen patiently, give godly advice, pray with them, offer help where possible. Otherwise, we risk starting a cycle of complaining about someone complaining. A person comes and talks your ear off about what they're going through, and then you go to your spouse and say, you wouldn't believe what brother so-and-so was bending my ear about. He wouldn't stop about this and that. And then your spouse goes to the person at work the next day, and my husband is dealing with so much from this other guy, and now we have a lot of people who are saying, if everyone would just stop complaining, I would just finally be happy. And, well, don't we see the foolishness in that? So don't make the determination for them on the listening side. Simply do what you can. But complaining is also not simply an honest admission to God or to others of how difficult it is to do right sometimes. I realize, I hope at least, that in our prayers to God, we will frequently tell Him that we are struggling. We know and we understand that it is truly hard to be holy, to live the kinds of lives that we are called to live, to be holy as He is holy. If you don't find that to be a challenge, I would submit that you might not be doing it right. You might not be grading yourself as strictly as we need to at times. If we say, I don't have any trouble with that. I avoid sin just like it's no problem at all. I don't think that is the experience for most people. And if we come to God confessing that we wonder at times how we can make it through a trial, if we can make it through a trial, we recognize that I'm not going to be able to do this by myself. What do you want me to do, Lord? That is not a grumbling complaint. That is simply reflecting the truth of the matter. If we see our dependence on God, our need for Him to get through something, that helps us to appeal to His strength, which is much greater than ours, and to rely upon His grace and His mercy. That is not the kind of complaint that we should avoid. If we tell the Lord, my God, I am trying to do what is right, but it is difficult for me. That is simply acknowledging what is the real substance of the matter. So, if we're talking about what complaining isn't, what are we talking about? What is it to grumble, to complain? Well, it's what we see Israel engaging in so frequently. What we just took a brief trip through in Exodus and Numbers. Oftentimes these are complaints simply to let other people know that we are unhappy. And there is no real resolve or desire to change or to improve our state. I am not airing a grievance so that we can work towards a solution. I just want you to know that I'm unhappy and that you should probably be unhappy too because things are not going very well. This grumbling or complaining has no profit to it. There's no benefit whatsoever that is found at the end. It reveals ultimately a lack of faith, a lack of perspective. Usually, not always, but usually, the kind of complaining we are concerned with is about trivial things. Things that, even if we don't look at them for very long, really don't matter very much. Have you not found it to be true, just by your own experience, anecdotally, that the people who complain the very least are the people who are actually having to deal with the very most? The person who is under a terrific burden, the person who is suffering legitimate, terrible things in their lives, the person who has so much that they could complain about, and you never hear a peep out of them. Instead, the people that we hear the most are the ones whose toast got burnt that morning, and you're going to hear about it for the next week at work. You're thinking, this can't be that important. But it's the trivial things that we simply can't let go. What do we complain about? What is it that we hear grumblings concerning? Decisions made by other people seems to be a popular topic. Whether it is our government, whether it is the boss at work, whether it is the principal at school, maybe it's the elders of the church, maybe it's my spouse or my parents, whether it's in the home, the government, anywhere else, anywhere in between, if someone is making a decision for us, the tendency is to second guess, to complain, to grumble. This is what Moses had to deal with so regularly. Why you, Moses? Aren't we all God's children? Why should you be the man in charge? Hasn't he revealed himself to each of us? Now you're making these decisions and we don't like them. All the same, though, we often hear complaints about the responsibilities that we have to shoulder. We don't want another person making decisions for us, but we don't want to have to be the person that makes the decisions. So as the leader, might we complain about what I have to tell the kids to do and what I have to do for the children and what I've got to do with these people at work who I just have to hold their hand through every little thing. Or these sheep, as I am the shepherd of the church and I see the sheep aren't doing what I wish and so I complain about them. Not speaking of myself, of course, but maybe one would have that attitude. Maybe the governor of a particular place, a political leader, who looks and sees all these things that his people are doing that he doesn't want them doing, and everything is just a complaint about why no one will get in line. We find a perceived slight, a minor infraction from another person. He looked at me with a look that I didn't quite like. He said, "Hello, how are you doing?" But I could tell he really didn't mean it. We find these things that just irk us about other people. Of course, as adults, we complain about having too much to do, just being too busy to get everything done in a given day. You might, maybe not as much now, but in the summer, as a parent, you might have heard your children complaining about not enough to do. I'm bored. I want to go do something. Not a complaint that really ever flew in my house. That was a quick way to get kicked outside, no matter how hot it was. But maybe we complain about too much to do, maybe not enough to do, maybe not being able to do the things that we want to do. I want to do this thing, but God says that I can't, and that really is not fair to me. Shouldn't I be able to enjoy myself? Maybe the daily annoyances. As Houstonians, we have our favorite list of things, the traffic, the weather, all of the noise. Maybe you complain about having loud neighbors. Maybe you complain about the slow service at a restaurant. Maybe a minor ache or just a nagging pain in my ankle that I can't get rid of, and we just need everyone to know about that. We might be getting the point, and we're not trying to give an exhaustive list. We've been around those who are grumblers. The question is, what do we complain about? Anything. Everything. What happened this morning? I'll find something wrong with it. I'll find something that I could turn into a negative and spend a few minutes telling you about the difficulty therein. What does the New Testament have to say about complaining? Very quickly, we can look at several things. First, a couple of commands to the negative. We find Paul in Philippians chapter 2, and we're going to give these passages without a great deal of comment from me, largely because they speak so well on their own merit. They stand up on their own legs with the forthright language that Paul uses to deliver them, or Peter in the second case. But here we find Paul in Philippians 2 in verse 14 telling the saints in Philippi to do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Don't we think part of that light that he is talking about in verse 15, some of that separation from the world and an ability to be seen as something different and something better, a light to the darkness of the world, isn't part of that demarcation made by their ability to do all things without complaining and disputing? That's not the natural order for many people. But a Christian can bear up under difficulty. A Christian can find himself persevering through the strain. A Christian can deal, they can handle, they can do all things without complaining and disputing, or as some other versions might say, they're grumbling or arguing. Just simply do what you must. Do what you have been called to do. And everyone doesn't need to hear about how bad it is and how unfair it is. In 1 Peter chapter 4, the Apostle Peter would give fairly similar instructions. Again, just a short, simple statement in the midst of other practical wisdom that the Spirit is inspiring him to say here. But in verse number 9 of 1 Peter chapter 4, be hospitable to one another without grumbling. Here again, being called to do something that might come with some difficulty or might put us out to some degree, you have to show kindness to someone else. In verse 8, he will describe having fervent love, being involved in that regularly, having fervent love for one another. In verse 10, he will talk about our service to one another in whatever way we can. But with all of that, we do so without grumbling, without bringing a complaint forward every time we think that it is necessary. So, simply put, the New Testament, when we're considering complaining, would tell us, don't do it. Don't voice those complaints, those useless, profitless, invalid, illegitimate things that we find to whine about. Just keep them silent. Positively, we would find some admonitions in the opposite direction. Romans chapter 12 and verse 12. Again, another passage filled with practical, everyday wisdom. But we find in verse 12 of that chapter, Paul telling us to rejoice in hope, to be patient in tribulation, to continue steadfastly or faithfully in prayer. They're being patient in all tribulation. Is the complaining person usually a patient person? He bears up under everything and waits for so many years, and then all of a sudden just turns into the human crybaby after he's been so patient and so good for so long. No, the complainer is usually one who is very impatient in trial and just can't put up with that for very long whatsoever. We've been studying, as I mentioned, from Galatians in our Sunday morning class. We just finished that today. But one of those qualities mentioned as the fruit of the Spirit, the byproduct of walking by the Spirit, living as God has called us, living according to His revealed will and wisdom, one of those traits, in fact, in the first half at least, long-suffering, a word that in its very construction tells us what it requires. Suffering long, putting up with something, bearing with a difficulty. Again, that is at odds completely with the person who at the first sign of trouble does not suffer long, but they immediately begin crying aloud, voicing their complaints and grumbling and whining to every person who comes into contact with them. The fruit of the Spirit, what God desires of us, if we are sowing to the Spirit, is that we would be people who are patient, who can bear with others, who can suffer long with and for others. Well, we understand we are not supposed to do it. Hopefully we understand a bit of what we're talking about when dealing with a complaining spirit. But we do want to spend the remainder of our time thinking about how do we fix it. I would hate to deliver a sermon that just sounds like a complaint. All you people, quit your complaining, please, for my sake, if no one else's. We don't want to leave things there. How do we fix the problem, if in fact it is a problem we struggle with? Let us begin at the root, the starting point of all of this. Choose to be grateful instead. Count your blessings, as the familiar song goes. These two things might very well be direct opposites. Gratitude and complaint. And in fact, so many of the things that we complain about are things for which we actually should be grateful. You complain about how hard the job was today, and how much you hate the boss, and how much you don't want to be going into that place every day. But isn't having that job much better than not? I know many of you know from recent experience how bad it is to not have work, how bad it is to be looking for something to do, to be able to support yourself, to be able to support your family, to be able to provide good. When we don't have that, we sorely miss it. When we do have it, we should not complain about it. You might say, and I'm guilty of this, after a big meal, oh, I ate too much. And I've been eating too much. I mean, I just haven't been doing well at all. I just, oh, it's really been terrible. I mean, I need to quit doing that. Complaining about the plenty that we have in front of us. If we knew the pain of going hungry for even a day, would those complaints come to us as readily? We complain after that nice big meal. Oh, I got dishes to do. This is going to take forever. Scrubbing the pans, doing all that kind of stuff. I hate having to do that. Aren't you glad to have food to put on those plates? Aren't you glad to have some nourishment that thousands, millions of people in this world go without? Oh, the kids are misbehaving again. And we complain to everybody within earshot. They just won't listen. They're just so rotten at this age. You know how they can be. Would you trade those children for anything else in the world? I would struggle to find a parent here who would say, yeah, I don't really need him. Keep the younger one, but I'm a baby boy. But no, you love those children more than anything else in this life. Don't complain about them. Be grateful for them. Instead of a complaint, as an exercise, say a prayer of gratitude for the thing that you are about to start bitterly bewailing that you have to deal with it. Complaining about how crummy your car is, be thankful that you have one. Complaining about how long the line at the bank is, be grateful that you have something to put into that bank. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 18 tells us, in everything give thanks. We understand. In fact, we looked at this in a lesson not too long ago. That does come with some difficulty, doesn't it? Because not everything in this life seems good when it happens to us at the moment. And some things are simply bad. But in everything, we can give thanks. There is profit that we can find in the situation we might be complaining about. I would say this not only helps the problem in a concrete way, an immediate way, by doing just one thing instead of the other. All right, this time, instead of whining about it, I'll be grateful. Okay, it does help in that limited sense, but gradually, will this not transform the kind of person that you are so that you are truly more grateful? As we talked about this morning, if you sow to the flesh, you reap the flesh. If you sow to the Spirit, you reap to the Spirit everlasting life. If you sow gratitude, that is what you reap. It's not just a one-time thing. You're changing your character and the kind of person that you are. We would also be helped greatly by considering others. And some of this goes hand in hand with what we talked about a moment ago, being grateful for what we do have. There is always someone who is worse off in the world and would love to be in the position that you are in. They would love to have the problems that you are having to deal with, and to face the kinds of things that you are offering these complaints about. I think of some of the churches that are receiving those letters that Paul wrote to them. We read earlier from Philippians chapter 2, verse 14, where he tells them to do all those things without complaining, grumbling, or arguing. Paul is writing that letter from prison. Paul is writing that letter wondering at the time, is Caesar going to drag me before him and have me beheaded, or is he going to give me my freedom? Isn't it easier maybe for someone like, those two women that he names in chapter 4, Euodia and Syntyche, that he says, you two need to be of the same mind, you start getting along. I don't know what it was they were disputing about and probably complaining at each other over, but I would tend to guess that it was not life or death, that they were not facing imprisonment or beheading. And so we can wonder, what's Paul going through? Is it difficult for him? And wouldn't he maybe rather be in our shoes at times? Besides this, though, for considering others before voicing the complaint, simply think of the demoralizing effect that our complaints have on their frequent hearers. How we can slowly, over time, beat someone down with the negativity, with the grumbling, with the murmuring that we constantly feed them about everything in our lives. If you have been in many conversations with people who are prone to this kind of conversing, you understand how difficult it can be for you. Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 4 what kind of speech we are to specialize in. Verse 29, not corrupt words, but what is good for necessary edification, words that might impart grace to the hearers. Brethren, you can speak corrupt words that don't have four-letter curse words in them at all. You can speak corrupt words simply by bitterly complaining, by constantly bringing these grumblings to your brethren's ears. Speak to them instead what is good. Give them a break sometime and talk about the things that are going well, that you are grateful for, that we can rejoice in. We are meant to grow from our trials. James tells us in chapter 1 of his epistle, verses 2 and 3, that we should consider it joy when we fall into various trials. Because we know, he says, that the testing of our faith produces patience. I've long thought and said many times, I believe James does include what he says with good reason, as he was inspired by God. But we would not be doing a disservice to that passage to end it with the word produces. The testing of your faith produces. It does something. It provides a benefit. We are meant to grow from the things that are difficult in our lives, not to simply sit there complaining about them. If you read any good story worth its salt, any story that has a hero, that has a protagonist, the hero triumphs over the difficult circumstance. He grows. He has a character arc. He meets a difficulty and he perseveres and he finds what is true strength that he can rely upon and he overcomes the trial and wins in the end. We are all too often the annoying side character in the story of our own lives. We don't act like the hero who, even though everything goes wrong and he's thrown in prison unjustly and has everyone forsake him and has all these terrible things, but he rises from the ashes and returns to victory. Oftentimes we are not that hero. We're the comic relief or one of the low-level bad guys who is standing around saying, "Oh, you're going to do that? Oh, we have to put up with this? Oh, that's going to take a while to get over," and it's only a complaint that comes forth from us. We have our God fighting for us. We have many can assist when needed, but we will be put to the test. That is the simple reality of life, and we're all aware of that. Don't be defeated by circumstance. Don't be defeated by those difficult things that you face, by the trials. Overcome them. Through Christ, prevail and grow by that. Use hardships, not to tell everyone about them and how bad you have it, but to continue growing. Even big things, so to speak, are treated with a healthy dose of perspective in the New Testament. If you find 2 Corinthians chapter 4, we find Paul even talking about very serious persecution, maybe even to the point of death in many cases, as being something which was light. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning in verse 17, he says that light affliction, which is our outward man perishing, someone harassing you for your faith, someone beating you for your faith, someone killing you for your faith, that light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. In his letter to the Romans, chapter 8, and verse 18, we've always loved the way that he describes the things which are ahead in comparison to the things which are now. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. There is no comparison. They do not stand even in the same place. The things of this life, no matter how galling they are to us, no matter how truly difficult they are, simply don't compare to what is at stake eternally. We have to live in view of that greater reward. If we are complaining at all times, we are not focused on what is truly important. We are focused only on what's happening right now. Set your eyes on higher things. Look to the eternal. A final solution or piece of advice more than anything else this morning is to monitor ourselves. Sometimes we don't truly know our own hearts, and we certainly don't know our own behavior because we see it through a faulty mirror. We see it the way that we wish to see it, and it comes through many fractures in that glass where we don't get a true sense of the real picture. It's necessary sometimes to adjust and to recalibrate. I would encourage us to watch for this idea that we're talking about this morning. The grumbling, the disputing, the murmuring, the complaining, whatever word we want to use for it. Be on the watch for it in your own life. Just do it for a week. Let's all determine for this week, until Saturday night, really try to notice if you catch yourself complaining about something that doesn't really matter, that isn't helped by your complaint, that isn't imparting grace to the hearer that you're venting it to, that isn't helping you to overcome a trial, that isn't showing your faith, your persistent faith in God and His provision for you. Try to see if you can catch yourself doing that. Maybe there is a problem there that you're not even aware of. Some of us might discover by Tuesday afternoon, well, I've been doing that like He told us to do, and I've caught myself 50 times having to stop because I was about to put some poor soul through the ringer telling him about how bad my day has been. Maybe I do need to work on this. If we are aware of the problem, we can fix it. That only works if we know about it. So I would encourage us to think about this seriously. This morning, tomorrow, like I said, maybe give it a week and see if we find in ourselves something that we do not like. We began this morning talking about those Israelites, that first generation of the people of Israel, the people who would eventually become God's own special people in that day and age. And we talked about their consistent complaint against the Lord. What we find reflected also in those stories, however, in Exodus and Numbers, in that 78th Psalm, is a God who repeatedly answered those complaints. They wanted food, and He gave them food. They wanted water, and He gave them water. They were worried about enemies coming over the hills, and He destroyed every last one of the enemies. This is not to say that the squeaky wheel gets the oil. The way to secure blessings from God is by grumbling about it. Don't mistake that for the point. The point is that despite our own faults and our own shortcomings, our own deficiencies, the God that we serve is merciful. He does desire what is ultimately and truly best for us and has gone to great, great lengths to secure that ultimate good for us and provide everything that we need. He has chiefly done this concerning our eternal salvation, that eternal glory that we are talking about that is not fit to be compared with the mundane things of this life. He sent His own Son, His only begotten Son, to suffer, to die, to bleed on our behalf on a cross on Calvary. He's done that so that we can be saved. He has given us redemption through Him, redemption through His blood. And we stand this morning appealing to you that if you have not obeyed our Lord's gospel, have not taken advantage of that sacrifice, that you need to do so. You need to become a Christian. We talked this morning in Galatians chapter 6 in our class hour about sowing and reaping, the very fundamental principle of life that a man reaps what he sows, and mentioned there that the determining factor in the harvest is not the reapers, it is the sower. It's what is put in to begin with. There will not be a valid complaint that any of us will be able to make at judgment. We will not be able to say, God, You are doing something which is unfair. God, You are doing something that I did not choose. God, You didn't tell me what I needed to do. We make the determination right now whether we will receive a wonderful harvest of eternal life or a terrible one of decay and ruin. But you decide. The only complaint in the end that we would be able to make would be against ourselves for being so foolish while we had the time to do differently and to do better. Don't let that be the case. If you have the need this morning to obey our Lord, come forward right now and do that while we stand and sing this song.